Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with the pleasure of having Jim McCormick joining us from Canada today, professor of political science at Iowa State University. He's visiting Carleton University in Ottawa. Jim McCormick, welcome to our program from Canada. Jim, are you there?
I am.
Okay, now we hear you. It took a little while for the signal to get across the border.
Okay, thank you very much for having me on.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about your position there a little bit later in the program. Sarah Mitchell is with us as well, the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, much closer in our Iowa City studio. Hello again, Sarah.
Hello, thanks.
Jim and Sarah will be talking a little bit later in our program about the latest repeal bill by the Republicans. We heard a bit about that in the news regarding Jimmy Kimmel. The Republicans would like to undo much of the Affordable Care Act. This is the last, Groundhog Day is one word that comes to me. We thought we were done with this in the summer. Then it's coming again. There's a deadline coming up. We'll talk about that in just a minute and why that's pushing the GOP's legislative agenda on health care again. Also, we'll talk about the Russia investigation. The Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by our own Senator Chuck Grassley, announced it will consider two bills to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller from being fired. That later, front and center, we want to talk about President Trump's address before the United Nations yesterday, and to reach out to you, our River to River listeners, what are your questions, your observations about President Trump's vision for U.S. leadership in the world as outlined in his U.N. address? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. You can tweet us as well at IPR Talk. Well, he picked out several nations for harsh words. He picked out Iran, Venezuela, first and foremost, North Korea. Here's one of his comments that has stood out in our news.
The United States has great – we can no longer be taken advantage of or enter into a one-sided deal where the United States gets nothing in return. The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary.
Okay. President Trump yesterday. Jim McCormick, specifically to his comments about North Korea, your reaction?
Well, I'm not sure that he's was successful in really rallying the members of the UN to really join a coalition for him against North Korea. I think maybe the tone he struck was probably a little bit too negative. I think there is a real perception about Kim Jong-un and the danger that he poses. But, you know, using this kind of language and almost precipitating the movement towards war, I suspect does not endear himself with the large majority of members of the United Nations. So while he set out a marker here with regard to North Korea, I'm not sure that he gained any additional support with the speech.
Mm-hmm. Reaction specifically to that completely destroying North Korea remark there, some audible reaction within the UN chamber, reports say there as well. Also some faces with some reaction there. Sarah Mitchell, what did you think of the remarks towards North Korea there? Helpful in any way?
I think it was unusual because in the past, U.S. presidents have made statements against leaders but not the people of a country. And President Trump's statement was more of a blanket threat, I think, towards all of North Korea. So that's one thing that stands out. I also think he mentions later in the speech that he could revisit the Iranian deal. And so in that case, that's a treaty that was negotiated over two presidential administrations, brought together lots of major powers. So the idea that we would walk away from that deal, I think, makes any multilateral negotiation with North Korea more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Staying with North Korea for the moment, Jim, have we moved anywhere? It seems like especially you are a longtime analyst on our program here that, you know, North Korea, we talk about it in the same way again. Now it's escalating. Is there a point at which, well, besides the obvious point of some kind of war breaking out, in which there is a way out of this?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that this speech indicated was the real frustration that the president and maybe the United States has had in terms of getting the attention of Kim Jong-un. On the one hand, by pointing out his rocket man scenario and all this, it raises the stature of the North Korean dictator. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that it brings that North Korean leader any closer to negotiations, because he has achieved what he wanted. He got the kind of international stature. He continues to develop his missiles, and there are and nuclear tests. And there seems to be no immediate, you know, rallying for, yes, there's talk about here, even in Canada. You know, one of the reactions this morning was that the prime minister called for more negotiations to settle this matter. But the problem has been to try to bring in the North Korean leader into those talks. And I think there's skepticism on the part of American administrations. Going back to actually Bill Clinton, they've tried to negotiate. All the succeeding presidents have tried to negotiate. Anytime they make a deal with North Korea, within about 3 or 4 months, North Korea backs away from it. So I think that the part of the kind of language here and the tempo that the president struck is the kind of frustration that the United States is really feeling.
Let's talk a little bit about China here as a key player. The president has tried to lean on China in various ways to get it to work on North Korea, leverage North Korea, North Korea's closest ally, if you can call – I guess you can call China an ally of North Korea, or what is the status?
Absolutely, sure.
Mm-hmm. This is from the English language edition of the People's Daily Newspaper with an op-ed referring to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. That's what we call North Korea. Trump threatens the North Korea with total destruction while China calls for peaceful settlement. Trump's political chest dumping is unhelpful and will only push the DPRK, North Korea, to pursue even riskier policies because the survival of the regime is at stake. What do you think of that analysis put forth in the People's Daily Newspaper in China?
I think it was actually interesting in the speech because Trump did not really directly refer to China. He talked about the South China Sea's territorial claims, and he mentioned trade issues that are relevant with China, but he didn't actually mention China by name. So that I thought that was an interesting
mm-hmm. Does that tell you perhaps that he's exhausted the avenue with China? He has been tweeting about China in this context for a long time. I don't know if we can interpret silence there as
anything.
What's
surprising is that, you know, China and Russia have been trying to get the U.S., South Korea, and Japan to decrease their own military exercises in exchange for some kind of reduction of missile tests by North Korea. And in this case, you know, Trump doubled down in a sense on threatening North Korea. And so, again, I think that it puts China in a more difficult negotiating position because they're trying to offer a diplomatic solution to reduce tensions. And I think in this, you know, there were three themes in the speech. He talked about sovereignty, security, and prosperity. And I thought, again, what's fascinating is that he, on the one hand, talked about territorial integrity as an aspect of sovereignty, but then later, you know, made these statements in a similar way that George W. Bush did in the Axis of Evil speech, basically saying that, you are a sovereign regime until we don't like what you're doing. So I thought it was kind of an interesting tension in how he treated sovereignty, a word that he used 21 times, I think, in the speech.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Just to pick up on that, also a line from the New York Times, if I can quote that, because it goes so much with what you just said, Sarah. Mr. Trump offered the General Assembly a strikingly selective definition of sovereignty, threatening to act aggressively against countries like North Korea, Iran, and Venezuela, whose policy he opposes, yet saying almost nothing about Russia, which seized territory from its neighbor Ukraine and meddled in the presidential election. Do you see it in cases as a highly selective speech in this way, Jim McCormick?
Yes, it was. I mean, it really reflected. When I first started listening to the speech yesterday and then reading it, you know, here is somebody speaking at the United Nations. Yes, the UN Charter talks about the sovereignty of states and so on that join. But the real purpose of the UN, as it has evolved, is to try to bring nations together and to kind of create a rule-based international order. But President Trump goes on and on talking about sovereignty of states, and then he comes to the punchline here. Well, when we don't, as Sarah indicated very adroitly here, when we don't like a state, we feel the right to intervene here, and I think that will come back to haunt the Trump administration, because those states that have been threatened by the U.S. What I sort of wrote down here, the rogue five states, the rogue states of five rather than George Bush's axis of evil three states, they're going to come back and say, well, you know, you stay, leave us alone. This is our sovereignty here. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is this kind of sort of dualism here in the terms of the use of sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University. He's visiting Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada, as a Fulbright scholar. Sarah Mitchell is with us in our Iowa City studio of the University of Iowa. Join our conversation in the first part of this Politics Wednesday, talking about the president's address before the United Nations yesterday. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, river2river, at iowapublicradio.org. Let's talk about the other, rogue nation that the president had harsh words for. Here's what, in part, what he had to say about Iran.
The Iranian government masks a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of a democracy. The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. It is time for the entire world to join us in demanding that Iran's government end its pursuit of death and destruction.
A deal that is an embarrassment to the United States. Jim, remind us of that deal with Iran that was a long time in the making under the Obama administration.
Yes, it was. It goes back to, about 2011, maybe, in 2012, when they finally had began negotiations, and then they struck a preliminary agreement in 2013, and then, of course, the final agreement was in 2015, and it was an agreement between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one, that is the permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, that really struck this agreement, although I think most of the heavy negotiations were done by Secretary of State Kerry and his counterpart with Iran. And what it required was the reduction of the use of centrifuges and how much they could enrich uranium down to a 5% level, and with a whole series of inspections by the international community to make certain that Iran would live up to that. Those commitments, and in exchange, the sanctions that the European Union and what the United States had placed upon Iran would be lifted here.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an economic kind of exchange for this political rejection, or at least temporary holding off on development of nuclear weapons, because it was a 10 year with up to a 15 year window here and make for that agreement.
And under the 8 months or so of the Obama or of the Trump administration, is the United States holding up to its end of the bargain?
Well, it has lifted the sanctions. I mean, they were lifted in kind of an orderly fashion. Although the Trump administration has said that they want to put back on those sanctions, and of course the Europeans have lifted those sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Iran has in fact complied with the inspection so far. In terms of if you think it's an unfair deal, I mean, you could point to the fact that there were no concessions that had to be made with support for groups like Hezbollah abroad. Israelis might criticize the agreement in terms of it's merely delaying the development of nuclear program rather than preventing it altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you see this as a theme in Trump's foreign policy approach, that this kind of America first, is America getting a good deal or not? He made similar statements about our contributions to the United Nations in terms of them being asymmetric. He made statements about that with respect to our trade agreements. But I think, as Jim mentioned earlier, the idea of creating a liberal order is that the hegemonic state pays costs to create institutions, free trade, and it pays more of those costs because it creates lots of markets for its goods. It helps to promote democracy abroad, which stabilizes investment in markets. So I think we can think about America first, but we also have to think about costs that we're paying when we pull back from these multilateral agreements.
So what I'm getting from you is perhaps President Trump has a narrower view of it, sort of this transactional relationship with different countries and problem states, whereas other statesmen, other presidents would have seen it, as you describe, more broadly?
Yeah, I think, the entire – if you think about the United Nations and other institutions created at Bretton Woods, like the IMF or the GATT, which became the WTO, I mean, these are all part of a system of institutions that promotes democracy, trade, investment abroad. And so I think in Trump's doctrine, America first, and as Professor Colin Call, he was on campus this week, he said his other doctrine is anything but Obama. So he also seems to be moving away from agreements that were negotiated under Obama, which is mm-hmm. true of the Iranian deal.
Let me go to – I think this is The Atlantic. Also to your comment, to quote The Atlantic – In reaction, comment on this speech, Donald Trump's first speech to the United Nations can best be understood as a response to his predecessor's final one. September 20th, 2016, Barack Obama told the UN General Assembly that, in his words, this is a quote, "At this moment, we all face a choice. We can choose to press forward with a better model of cooperation and integration, or we can retreat into a world sharply divided and ultimately in conflict along age-old lines of nation and tribe and race and religion." 364 days later, according to The Atlantic, Trump delivers the answer, which is option number two. Is that how you see it, Jim, that we're going 180 degrees in the other direction in terms of nationalism versus globalism?
Oh, yes. I think that's entirely the case. I mean, the speech in so many ways with talking about those – what Trump identified as the sort of the three pillars of security and prosperity and seeking peace through the nation-state system, I really think really reflects what that comment is about. So the whole theme was the power of the nation state. And he talks about at one juncture, he labels this principal realism. And, realists, of course, would give great honor to the integrity of the state and whatever the state wanted to pursue here. And that is really reflected in what President Trump was saying yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to break, let's go to a caller or two. Nick is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Nick. Not much time before we go to break, but what's your question or your reaction to the president's words yesterday?
Yeah, I think thanks for taking my call first, and hopefully this is kind of a quick question. But
sure.
When we talk about trying to prevent the nuclear arms race, I don't think it's realistic today to say, well, they won't have it within 10 years. North Korea is a prime example. So is the White House administration boxing itself in by saying North Korea will not have them? Because I think we have to identify that Iran will have nuclear weapons within 20 years. And what do we do then?
Mm. Comment on that, Sarah. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think on the North Korea side, what's changed recently is that in the past, the reach of their nuclear and conventional arsenals were local. And now the missile tests that they've been conducting are potentially posing a threat to U.S. homeland targets. So in some senses, the North Korea situation is evolving more into a Cold War type scenario. And in that situation, I think deterrence becomes more difficult because you have to convince you have to convince Japan that you would trade Tokyo for Toledo, or you have to be willing to pay costs and have costly signals of your commitment. And in some senses, Trump, so he criticized the South Koreans as being appeasing of North Korea. He threatened to withdraw from the free trade agreement with South Korea. So he's doing things that is not reassuring our allies in that region. And that's creating a problem, I think, for extended deterrence in that particular situation.
Mm-hmm. Jim, what do you think about Nick in Des Moines' comment?
Well, I think, he makes one interesting point, it seems to me, in terms of how quickly Iran might be able to develop nuclear weapons. If you think about what North Korea did, I think their first test was in 2006, and now in 2017, of course, they have also got, missile that, as Sarah was saying, can reach the United States and endanger, the homeland and so on. And given the kind of expertise that Iran has, if in fact there would be a breakout, even under the best scenarios with this pact, they could have a nuclear weapon within 1 year. They've already been testing, and that's sort of course one of the things that the Trump administration is concerned about, is that they've been testing missiles, even though that was not covered under the Iran agreement. They have been testing these longer-range missiles here, and that's really the danger, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. And as far as missile development, Iran further ahead than North Korea, even though North Korea making tremendous strides here. Do we know?
No, I don't.
Go ahead.
No, I don't think so. I think North Korea is much further ahead in terms of its development.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem is that. The North Korea situation is one of what I would call brinksmanship, where the two sides are taking steps to strengthen their position but remain short of war. But surprisingly, if you look at the data, countries with nuclear weapons don't escalate their crises to severe levels as much as countries without nuclear weapons. So they could actually be a force for peace.
Sarah Mitchell is with us at the University of Iowa. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Politics Wednesday, when we come back, a little bit more about the president's speech before the UN yesterday. Then we'll talk about the latest repeal bill by Republicans to undo much of the Affordable Care Act. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, and picking apart the president's speech yesterday. In his sights, he took aim at, first and foremost, the North Korean regime there, also Iran, but also Venezuela. Let's have our analysts comment about that after hearing what the president had to say about Venezuela yesterday.
The Venezuelan people are starving, and their country is collapsing. Their democratic institutions are being destroyed. This situation is completely unacceptable, and we cannot stand by and watch. As a responsible neighbor and friend, we and all others have a goal. That goal is to help them regain their freedom, recover their country, and restore their democracy.
Jim McCormick, unlike Iran or North Korea, Venezuela, not so much in our news in the past few years. Addressing what the president had to say there, what are the U.S. interests there? Why are we concerned about Venezuela?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that Venezuela is an oil supplier. It's a member of OPEC and so on, and that's of some interest to us, although we have obviously moved to other sources of oil. I think the other thing is that there was, you know, a great sweep of democratization that had taken over Latin America, and, you know, with this regime and with the predecessor regime, they've moved away from democratic principles here. So I think that both the democracy dimension as well as the economic dimension is part of the interest that the United States has in Venezuela here, as well as, if you think more broadly, we think of Latin America in terms of being in America's backyard and so on. And we would like to obviously have a friendly regime. We would not like to have another Cuba in the hemisphere and so on.
Mm-hmm. Justin is Des Moines is joining us from Des Moines. Justin, if you're still there, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I guess the article you mentioned earlier in the Atlantic, I believe that was written by Peter Beinart. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but the point of his thing was that he was talking about Trump's call for sovereignty and how it actually appeared to him to be inconsistent with his behavior that's often imperialistic. And so my question was, how do we gauge some of Trump's previous behavior, whether it was calling as a candidate to take the oil in Iraq and then early on in his presidency, which is, I mean, it would constitute a war crime and is clearly imperialistic. How do we weigh that against his call for sovereignty? And similarly, I guess, I think his rhetoric was something like principled realism, but how do we weigh that against, again, where North Korea is in their missile development, nuclear development, and also with the Iran deal, it seemed like that was a realistic or a pragmatic pursuit that he has no interest in acknowledging the realism behind it. So thanks for taking my call.
Okay, Justin, thank you. Thank you in Des Moines. So nationalistic or imperialistic, perhaps, as Justin suggests from his reading of the Atlantic. Sarah?
I think there's two versions of Trump in the speech, and it's reflected in Justin's questions. So I think in the early parts of the speech, the way that he's describing sovereignty almost parallels the way that Vladimir Putin talked about sovereignty in 2015 in terms of non-interference and non-aggression by outsiders as being a cornerstone for sovereignty. But in the Venezuela part of the speech, he sounds more like a liberal internationalist, where he's talking about preserving democracy or protecting human rights. And so I thought there was an interesting tension in terms of how that the speech actually presented, again, the way we think about sovereignty and whether we would intervene either for democracy or human rights principles or to support self-determination movements. Or these are some of the things mm-hmm. that the liberal community has actually, they've violated sovereignty for some of those situations.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on from this UN speech to talk about some more domestic politics, Jim McCormick, have you had an eye on how some of our allies, our closest allies, for instance, in Europe have reacted to this speech? I see a report, the Swedish foreign minister crossing her arms during the speech and telling the BBC afterwards it was the wrong speech at the wrong time to the wrong audience. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel saying she would do everything in her power to ensure a diplomatic solution. Anything else would lead to disaster, she's quoted it saying as reaction to the president's speech here. What are you seeing in terms of reaction among our allies?
Well, I think the only one that has really a positive statement about it so far that I've seen has been Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. He lauded the speech, but all of the others, sort of have thrown cold water on the tone. I think there's probably more in terms of the substance that they might agree with about the dangers that some of these countries pose, but the tone that the president struck. And the kind of belligerence that was put forward, I think, turn some of these countries off. I mean, Elizabeth May has already apparently said that she will not support backing out of the Iran agreement. You know, the French president either spoke or held a news conference, I believe, right after Trump's speech and said that he would try to act as an interlocutor between the Americans and the Iranians in terms of any kind of division that they would have, and that that the French would not remove themselves from this agreement. Now, part of this is about both the British and the French, of course, and the Germans to, as well, is that they've taken advantage of lifting the sanctions, and they got economic interests, as well as American Boeing has interest in Iran after these sanctions have been lifted. So, though some of this is driven by their economic concerns, but I think it's really unlikely that even if Trump were to reject the Iranian agreement, that he could get European support for reimposing the sanctions, which were the thing by 2012 when the European Union imposed sanctions that turned the negotiations around that agreement.
Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University. If you've just joined us, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, our political analyst on this Politics Wednesday edition. Let's talk a little bit about the Republicans and their latest version of their Obamacare overhaul legislation called the Graham-Cassidy Bill. White House, other GOP leadership pitching this week to Senate Republicans. This supposedly, we thought it was a last-ditch effort like weeks ago when it failed, but this is supposedly the last-ditch effort to change the Affordable Care Act, a legislation introduced last week by Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy. Vice President Pence says the president backs the bill. It would undo much of the Affordable Care Act and send tens of billions of federal dollars to states with state discretion in a big way over how to spend the money. Here is one of the co-writers of the bill yesterday, the Republican senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham. He's saying he's confident about his proposal with Republican Senator Bill Cassidy that repeals the Affordable Care Act.
It's pretty well clear to me where the country's going under Obamacare and BernieCare. It's going into further bankruptcy. Is more decisions further away from where you live. And in 1996, we block-granted money for welfare reform, and it worked like a charm. We put governors in charge of the program. We held them accountable. So here's the choice for America, socialism or federalism, when it comes to your health care. Four states get 40% of the money under Obamacare. New York, California, Massachusetts, and Maryland, they represent 20% of the population. Our goal is by 2026 to make sure that every patient in every state gets the same contribution roughly from the federal government and allow people in your states to make decisions that would have been made in Washington. The most beneficial aspect of this bill is as follows. If you don't like Obamacare, who do you complain to? You can complain to me, but I sure as hell don't run it. If I can get South Carolina in charge of this money, that would have been spent in Washington by a bureaucrat who's unelected, I promise every South Carolinian the following. If you don't like your health care, somebody will listen to you. It's your governor and your state house representative. You can go to the state house representative who most likely goes to the same hospital you do. You can go to your governor who will listen to you because they care about your vote if nothing else.
Okay, extended clip there from Lindsey Graham, South Carolina. Senator in his support, obviously, of a bill that he introduced with Senator Bill Cassidy. Let's hear from the opposition. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke on the Senate floor yesterday about the Graham-Cassidy bill. He says that before there is a vote, there should be first a full estimate of the cost from the Congressional Budget Office.
I don't know how any senator could go home to his or her constituents and explain why they voted for a major bill with major consequences to so many of their people without having specific answers about how it would impact their state. What we do know is that this new Trump Care bill, the Graham-Cassidy legislation, is worse in many ways than the previous versions of Trump Care.
So Senator Schumer opposes the substance of the bill, he said as well, saying it would mean people would lose coverage, it would restructure and cut Medicaid, people with pre-existing conditions would not be protected. He also says the individual markets would go into chaos. So here we have the standoff once again, Jim. What are you seeing this time, this Groundhog Day, in terms of whether this will get across the line? It just needs 50 votes, right? And it was John McCain last time, a key vote that was denied to the Republicans.
Yeah, all the speculation is that, you know, there are three senators, Senator Collins, Murkowski, and McCain, that are really really the pivotal ones, and it's really Murkowski from Alaska and McCain from Arizona that are sort of key. I think Susan Collins has already indicated that she'll probably not support it.
Also, Rand Paul from the other end.
Rand Paul has said that he will not support it as well. So I think the effort is on Murkowski. I would be surprised if if Lindsey Graham cannot get his good friend John McCain to come and support it. So clearly, it's Lisa Murkowski from Alaska that they will have to try to make some bargain with her, because one of the complaints that she has, what I've read, is that the money under this block grant to Alaska would not be sufficient, given that health costs are higher in Alaska, and that maybe could be some sweetener. I agree with Yogi Berra. Making predictions about the future is really
well. When we look at
it's always dangerous. Here.
Reports of Republican governors across the country. Of course, a lot of states with Republican governors. The majority there. According to reports, they're split on this new bill. Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds also commenting on the proposal by Senators Graham and Cassidy, saying she thinks it's the only option.
Right now, this is the only vehicle that we have to address Obamacare that's failing.
Okay, your thoughts, Sarah Mitchell, on this last attempt to change under these parliamentary rules?
I think what's surprising about this bill is that it's, previous versions of Trump Care, as Jim called it, took the Affordable Care Act and made, some changes to it, but kept the structure of the ACA. This bill will change the rules of the ACA dramatically. So it would take a lot of federal spending to the tune of $1.8 trillion. It will reduce that spending by about 24%, and then it will shift the burden to the states to provide Medicaid and other funding. And so it's a states' rights kind of model, which is very Reagan-esque. I think the governors are complaining because they realize that these 24% cuts are then going to have to be made up at the state level. So they're going to have to come up with that money that's now taken away. And there's also a plan to shift states that have expanded Medicaid well under the Affordable Care Act will actually subsidize states that have not done it well. So there's a shifting from states who have done a good job, like Florida, in providing health care to states that have not done a good job.
Mm-hmm. Sarah and Jim, before we go, we have a few minutes left. I wanted to get your thoughts about the recent developments in what is usually called the Russia investigation, the Russia probe, specifically something relevant to Iowa. Yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee announced it will consider two bills to protect Special Counsel Robert Mueller from being fired as he investigates this possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Judiciary Chairman, of course, is our Senator Chuck Grassley. He's scheduled a hearing for next Tuesday, the 26th, to discuss the words of the spokesperson, special counsels and the separation of powers. According to his spokesman, Taylor Foy, the hearing will focus largely on two bipartisan bills to shield Mueller. Jim, your thoughts on that, perhaps tied up, there's so many arms and legs in this Russia investigation, but I wanted to point that one out because our senator is involved there.
Yeah, I think a couple points on that. I mean, first of all, what these bills really reflect is even among Republicans, the skepticism over what President Trump might want to do. And I think the second point is that, you know, here is congressional prerogatives that they're really trying to enforce, if you will, in terms of oversight and take actions. So I think both of those are at play with these kinds of proposed pieces of legislation here. Obviously the president could veto those, and the question is, would there be enough to override that, you know, from Democratic support? I mean, I think that would be sort of the question here.
Mm-hmm. What other developments are you watching in the investigation, Sarah Mitchell?
Well, I think Manafort's obviously coming under closer scrutiny. We now have evidence that he was, in fact, wiretapped as part of a broader investigation. So during the campaign, there's some speculation just as of yesterday that some of that wiretapping has Manafort talking with Russian officials. So I think it'll be interesting to see what gets revealed along those lines.
Mm-hmm. We have also former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, the other sort of big figure in this Russia investigation, now reports that Flynn served as a consultant on Middle East nuclear power plants involving Russian companies. And we remember it was his misrepresentations about repeated contacts with the Russian ambassador before he became the NSC advisor that led to his resignation there. Jim, are we any further? Are we waiting for – waiting for other developments? Of course, Robert Mueller knows where this is going, and so many people trying to figure out what his actions mean.
Yeah, I think the latest thing on Flynn too is that he's now refused to testify, so he obviously knows that they, or at least has got a good clue that they are moving forward with his case here. So I think it's sort of in a wait and see if will he get indicted for some action or inaction here.
Comment quickly. We only have a minute or two, Sarah, about this, the humanitarian crisis in the Southeast Asian country of Myanmar, also known as Burma. We have some over 400,000 refugees fleeing to Bangladesh, fleeing to one of the world's poorest countries. Allegations by the UN and others that there's ethnic cleansing going on.
Yeah, so this is surprising because the president, Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, she received the Nobel Prize for being, you know, a human rights activist. And she's basically, you know, within Myanmar, there's separation of power between the political power and the military power. And so this is a military cracking down on this group of people who came from the Bangladesh area of India. And so they've always been seen as outsiders. They don't have voting rights, which means that they have less rights in the educational system and other aspects of the country. So there's been discrimination against these people for a long time. It's just that recently there's been more, you know, violence that's being perpetrated by the military and the police against these people.
Jim McCormick, before we go, in the remaining minute or so, you are now living in Ottawa on a full...
Just temporarily.
On a Fulbright scholarship. That's a year term, right?
No, I'm just here for the semester.
Oh, you're here for the semester at Carleton University in Ottawa. Tell us, what is the focus of your time there?
Well, I got a research chair. I'm doing a little study here looking at Canadian foreign policy. I'm particularly interested in what they've been doing in Asia, and I wanted to compare it with the American policy towards Asia, particularly with the Obama administration's Asian pivot. So I've been doing some interviews and meeting with people and collecting some data here on some of their trade patterns and so on, and find it extremely interesting in terms of what they characterize as a middle power, what their role is in the world. And
They see themselves as a middle power? I thought we were talking Lord of the Rings there for a minute.
As a middle power. They're not a superpower.
Okay.
They're not one of the
Middle Earth. All right.
Yeah, but they're but they think they can be the bargainer between major powers, a fixer, as they call themselves, on some of these international issues. And that's why it would be interesting. I would urge Iowans to watch tomorrow from the UN when the Prime Minister is going to talk about that middle power role for Canada.
Jim McCormick, thank you very much. You're a professor of political science at Iowa State University, currently on a Fulbright for a semester in Ottawa, in Canada. Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury today. Help as well from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.